I see the American failure as part of the failure of the entire world outside Western Europe and Argentina for 6 World Cups in a row now.
Simon Cooper, great to speak with you. You have been covering the World Cup. You've, covered every World Cup since Italy back in 1990. You've just published a book about it called World Cup Fever, A Soccer Journey in 9 Tournaments. What's the first World Cup you remember watching?
It was 1978. I was 8 years old, and I'm not Dutch, but when I was 6, we moved to the Netherlands. So I grew up there, and I love Dutch football. I support Holland. In the 1978 World Cup final, I remember very clearly Holland-Argentina. In Argentina, Holland get the equalizer late in the game. In the last minute of full time, Rob Rensselaer hits the post for Holland. So I could have been world champion, my very first attempt. So like everybody else, I start watching World Cups on TV.
And you write that each new tournament reminds you of past tournaments that you've attended. This is your 10th in person, if my math is right. Which past World Cup has this one reminded you of the most?
Well, inevitably, somewhat 1994, I was here. I was actually living in Boston that year, and I got a small gig on TV as a spotter at games for ABC television. I was terrible at that because you had to identify a player who'd scored or got a yellow card or anything. My facial recognition skills are poor. So when I was in Boston during this World Cup, I went back to the North End where I'd spent many happy hours in 94 watching Italian soccer on TV during the Italian season and watched Norway, Ivory Coast there. So it was a homecoming, and the Foxborough Stadium was a homecoming from 94. The only time I've ever done that at a World Cup, I sort of retraced my steps.
How does the World Cup of 94 compare to this one?
94, it felt like it was a tiny niche within the US. So I watched games when I wasn't in the stadium in Foxborough. I'd watch games on TV in a bar in Boston where it was only immigrants, really. It was Nigerians, Moroccans, Bulgarians. We all had strong community because we were talking and obsessed by the same thing. And when you stepped out of the bar, the World Cup didn't exist. I remember going to Fenway Park during that World Cup to watch the Red Sox and talking to people, and they didn't know, literally, that there was a World Cup on. And now, of course, it's a much bigger event. And I would say that in the US, soccer has expanded from a tiny niche to a mid-sized niche. So even the biggest US games, it's about 10% of the population that watches. It's not very large.
Well, to your point, the World Cup is now the largest sporting event in the world. I was reading that FIFA is expected to net more than $9 billion. And then you have the resale tickets for next Sunday's final. They're listed between $20,000 and $35,000 a ticket. This was a question before the World Cup even started, but I think it's in some ways more resonant now. Who is this World Cup for?
Well, look, 99.99% of people who watch the World Cup are watching it on TV, you know, in Shanghai, in Soweto, in Buenos Aires. Most people never go to a World Cup game. So the World Cup is a television event where the stadium audience is decor. So who is the stadium audience, that tiny group of people? I mean, yes, certainly at the biggest games, it's going to be the super rich at the final. At other games, I've been struck by the size of the American diasporas. That's unique about this tournament, that every country has a diaspora here and the diaspora watches the World Cup. So at France, Iraq, a lot of Iraqi Americans. Brazil, Haiti, it's Brazilians and Haitians, or people who identify as such, but who live in the US, many of them probably US citizens. So you get, I think, often quite ordinary people who want to see their national team and are paying $2,000, which in normal soccer terms is an insane amount to watch it. I mean, it's shocking to me, as it is to most people from outside the US, that this has happened, because it's never been the tradition of the World Cup. I think at any past tournament, you can get into almost any game for under $100. The World Cup has never been seen as you sell tickets to the highest bidder. Typically, you know, a country like England, the tickets were given to the travel club, which consists of the people who watch England everywhere. So you look, if you're coming to the US to watch the World Cup, you're not poor. You're definitely part of the global middle class or above. But the ticket prices are an obscenity that I hope won't continue after this World Cup.
And part of FIFA's goal in having the World Cup in the States was to make as much money as possible. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. I mean, from sponsors as well. You know, from the world's most lucrative television market. So for television, we have these so-called hydration breaks, which are really advertising breaks, which most fans, including me, detest, which interrupt the flow of the game. And yeah, it's a money-maximizing World Cup from FIFA's point of view. As you're saying, $9 billion. And they'll keep a bit and they'll return a lot to the 200 national federations, everything Chinese Soccer Federation to the, you know, Western Samoa Soccer Federation. And though for many of the smaller federations, the only money they get in 4 years is their payout from the World Cup. So those national federation presidents want it to be as big as possible. And that's Gianni Infantino's promise to them, so they keep re-electing him.
And we should say, despite all the controversies ahead of the World Cup, there really has been some incredible soccer and some memorable moments. This is the first year where you've had 48 teams take the pitch, up from 32, far more matches. There was a concern initially that the soccer might suffer as a result. Have you seen any of that?
The quality is not as good as the best club soccer. Even with 32 teams, it wasn't. So club teams like Manchester City, Bayern Munich, Real Madrid, they would reach the semifinals of the World Cup. They could win the World Cup. There's only a couple of teams here that are as good as a top club team. I would say France and Spain are probably in that category. Nobody else. So the quality of the World Cup has not been what it's been about for decades now. So even with 32 teams, that was true. With 48 teams, that's even more true. You know, teams like Jordan or Uzbekistan, Curacao, it's not top football. Nobody believes that. But World Cups are not about quality, they're about drama. And the drama has been amply supplied. The small teams often using Western European diasporas like Morocco, where you saw their players born in Western Europe, produced decent football. We're still at the end of the situation where the top four seeds, essentially, France, Spain, England, Argentina, are in the semi, so there haven't been big upsets. But the small teams have acquitted themselves well, and I'm 99% sure that we will move very swiftly from 48 to 64 teams. So the quality will even more diminish. But the World Cup is a carnival. It's a festival of nations. It's about the drama, not the quality.
So when Gianni Infantino says we're looking at 64 teams, we should take that to mean 64 teams is pretty much confirmed for the next Cup?
I mean, he decides. FIFA is run largely by one man, the way, say, Putin runs Russia, the way Donald Trump liked to run US. If Infantino wants it, he says it will be considered by the relevant committees, meaning he'll check whether anywhere in the world there is opposition and never ignore that. It will be 64 teams.
What's your favorite game of this tournament so far?
I mean, I was at Argentina, Egypt, and Argentina, Cape Verde, which were great for drama. I mean, I really did think Argentina were going out, which is not an experience you often have with the reigning world champions. When Egypt were 2-0 up, we're about 20 minutes left. Egypt did defend terribly. Yes, refereeing decisions went such a team's way. So that game, I think, for drama, will be remembered a very long time. And France for quality. Just watching the French has been an experience of useful football.
Say that again. Watching the French has been what?
Watching the French has been an experience of beautiful football. I watched France-Sweden on TV in the Boston airport, and that was just a game that made you happy, a game that you'll remember for not the drama, but the beauty and quality of French.
Yeah. For casual fans, I guess we should explain, when you say they play beautifully, expand on that. What do you mean? What does it look like? How does the game unfold when you describe their manner of play being beautiful?
I mean, Pelé, the great Pelé, used the phrase jogo bonito, beautiful game, Portuguese, and that the idea of soccer as beauty is very strong. And it was best incarnated by certain French players like Michael Olise, Kylian Mbappé, Ousmane Dembélé. Olise's perfect balance, the way he sees everything on the field. Mbappé's ability to see the spot in goal that's unguarded and then to hit it from 30 yards. The way they interplay, the way that Mbappe knows where Elise is going to pass. Elise knows where Mbappe is going to move. Ousmane Dembele, this perfect technique where he hits the ball equally well with left or right foot. Beauty in football, it's interplay, it's technical mastery, and it's imagination. So Michael Elise sees the pass that you can't even see from your privileged position high in stacks where nobody is hitting you or breathing down your neck. Elise can see things on the field that you can't even see from 40 yards up.
Yeah, it's a real gift. You know, there's been some controversy around the actual ball in this tournament, that the ball itself has been seen as unpredictable. It's getting to goalkeepers faster than one might expect. What do you make of that?
I like it. I mean, it must be hard for goalkeepers because it does travel fast. It also seems to travel true. So what you see is a lot of shots from outside the box, like Julian Alvarez outside the penalty area. Julian Alvarez in Switzerland go in beautifully, exactly as the player intended, and faster than the keeper expected. So yeah, it's a ball that seems to favour attacking players. I like that. I remember conversely the World Cup 2010 in South Africa, also a new ball. Because there's always a new ball for marketing reasons. Kids around the world then go and buy it. 2010, the ball didn't travel truly, and so players kept missing, which is worse.
The heat has also been a dynamic in the sort of play that's unfolded. Obviously, this is happening in a North American summer. How do you see the conditions, the heat conditions, affecting the game and the play on the pitch?
I mean, often it's very clear. So I was at the England-Norway game in Miami on Saturday, and it was, I think, close to 90 degrees, very humid, and the players wilt. Performance weakens. They can't cover as much space. The space opens up. I think Erling Haaland, the great Norwegian, being giant, I think makes you more susceptible to heat, and he actually went off before time. Substituted, which ended Norway's chances. So yeah, it definitely reduces the quality. In a way, it increases the drama because the players are not just playing against each other's quality, they're also playing against the elements. It's like in a movie, you're fighting the elements. But it definitely is probably dangerous, and it reduces the quality of play.
How concerned is FIFA about player welfare? I raise the question because they're set to have a World Cup in Saudi Arabia in 2034. And one would expect that to be the heat to be far more dynamic than it has been here.
Yeah, either they'll do what they did in Qatar, which is move it to winter, the Saudi winter, you know, it's in the 70s, that would be fine. Or they'll air condition the entire stadiums, which is the case in a couple of US stadiums this tournament. And the Saudis would just pay for that. But then, you know, fans would be moving around in 120 degree heat, getting to the stadium, which would just be a complete nightmare. So I think they'll probably move the Saudi World Cup to Qatar set the press.
Yeah. Let's talk about the U.S. men's team, because despite a promising start and an obvious home advantage, they were beaten in the round of 16. What did you make of the U.S. performance?
I mean, the U.S. has actually not been improving for 20-odd years now. I mean, we track this in Soccernomics. Their peak FIFA ranking, I think, is the beginning of the century, and they're somewhere in the top 10. And they get worse. Why do they get worse? I think one reason is they play more games against North and Central American opponents. You know, in the region, they introduced the Gold Cup. And Northern Central America is not the region of high soccer quality. So if you're playing against even Mexico, Canada, Honduras, El Salvador, you're not playing the best football. To get better, you need to learn from the top football. The U.S. don't do that anymore. But also what you're seeing is not just the U.S. All the countries outside Western Europe and Argentina are failing to catch up. So that's true of the Asian countries, the African countries. And why is it? I think Western Europeans have kind of discovered the secret of football, which is about where should I be, geometry, how do you create space when you have the ball, shrink space when you don't have the ball. Big question in football match for a player. The player doesn't have the ball 88, 89 minutes. So his question or her question all the game is, where should I be? So it's kind of intellectual question. Football is a game you play with your head. And the Europeans are better at answering it, not just better than the Americans, but better than people from anywhere else in the world. So I see the American failure as part of the failure of the entire world outside Western Europe and Argentina for 6 World Cups in row now.
The book you mentioned, Soccernomics, which you co-wrote, and it asks why some countries win and others don't. You know, and you spoke about this, but why can't or why hasn't the U.S. been able to compete at the highest level? And where does U.S. men's soccer in particular go from here?
Well, you can't compete because you're in the wrong place. You play against weak countries in North and Central America. You're not linked. Your players don't grow up from age 6 understanding how to play soccer. Where should that be? Which is also why some U.S. players are actually Western European. So Sergio Dest grew up in Holland, learned his football there. Malik Tillman grew up learning football in Germany, his native country, really. Anthony Robertson in England. And so that shows to me that soccer is a game you have to understand. And you can be however fit you want, however passionate. You can even be very skillful, like Christian Pulisic. But if you don't understand the question of where should I be, who should I pass to, the decision-making, then you're never going to be very good. And you saw that US-Belgium. Belgium are not a great team. They just understand football in the way the Americans don't.
Well, after more than 100 matches, we're now down to the final four. And for the first time ever, it's FIFA's top four ranked team. So you've got France v. Spain. They're going to play in Texas. And then England versus Argentina, set to play in Atlanta. So talk us through each team and what you expect from these matchups.
Well, France, having been quite a dour defensive team for most of Coach Didier Deschamps' reign, are now a beautiful attacking flowing team. He's gone with his talent. He has three of the very best attackers in the world. Vincent Edouard, who's 2021, is going to join them on that level. And so if we just put all the talents in and the other seven block and supply the front line, and it's very hard to stop France from scoring. The best team in the world defending, stopping the opposition from scoring, is Spain. So how do you Spain defend? They defend by keeping the ball. Their game is about passing and possession, and their brilliance are just passing the ball to each other. And if Spain take the lead, it's hard for them to score because they advance quite slowly because their game is about possession. They don't do sudden quick breaks. But if Spain take the lead, you don't see the ball again. They just pass it to each other. So that's a very interesting dynamic, the best attacking team against the best defensive team. England-Argentina is really a battle of stars. England and Argentina are both quite flawed teams. They're defensively vulnerable. England particularly are not great at passing around. But the Argentinian game is messy. Messi doesn't move much. He's 39. He's lost the acceleration in his dribble, so he can't really beat players that easily, although he did a couple of times against Egypt at the end. Absolutely had to. But Messi is probably the best footballer in the history of football. And the game is to get him in the center on the ball and he will score. So it's a one-man team, really. And Messi goes where he wants. He doesn't defend. He walks. If Messi decides to go in the outside right position, the whole team will adapt to that. And England have two stars. Either of them is quite messy, but they're absolutely brilliant footballers. Harry Kane and Jude Bellingham. Harry Kane is a great center forward. And Bellingham is the man who makes runs behind him to positions you wouldn't expect. Bellingham plays the game at a higher pace than anyone. His technique is near perfect. And so I think Bellingham and Kane each have 6 goals this World Cup. Messi has 8. And so the whole game of both teams is just get the balls to those guys and see what happens, see what he does.
Will we ever see a shock winner again in the World Cup, or has the game just become in some ways too predictable?
I mean, soccer is the most unpredictable game in that it's low scoring. So you can have a really good team attack the whole game. They don't get a goal because it's very hard to score in football. And the weak team has one attack and it scores and wins 1-0. I mean, that happens. And because it's knockout, it's only in the knockout rounds, you only play one game. So it's not like, say, the NBA finals or playoffs where you play several games against each other. In one game, the underdog can win. And if the underdog wins in the knockout rounds 4 games in a row, which is unlikely but possible, yeah, then you could have a country like Norway or Ivory Coast winning the World Cup. Would I put money on it? Absolutely not. And you're right. In the history of football, it hasn't really happened. The last small country to win the World Cup was Uruguay in 1950, before the game was very developed. And since then, it's always been the big Italians. And it's very rare for a new country to win the World Cup. So all the 4 teams in the 70s have won the World Cup before.
I want to draw you out more on the impact of the game itself, because before the World Cup, you had some major host cities like Chicago completely opt out because they said it didn't make financial sense. And you've studied this. Do World Cups actually help host city economies, or is it like the Olympics where, in some cases, you have the host country being left with white elephants and they're holding the bag at the end of the games?
World Cups don't boost the economy. That's a very clear and consistent finding by academic sports economists over the decades. And we write about this in Soccernomics. So they don't increase GDP. They don't increase the number of jobs. They don't increase tourism to your cities. And one reason is that, yes, they attract few visitors who've come for the game, but they also drive away a lot of your ordinary tourists. So a city like Miami, where I am now, or New York, or Vancouver, would normally in summer get loads of visitors who were there to enjoy the city. Now, during a World Cup, those people mostly think, you know what, I'm not going to go to New York this summer because there's soccer, there's going to be high prices, and more of the intrusive security. I'll go somewhere else. So you lose a lot of your regular tourists. Then you're left with the costs, because FIFA's model is it takes all the money from the World Cup The host city can't even charge sales tax on ticket sales, and the hosts have to pay the costs. Now, thankfully, in the US, Mexico, and Canada, the stadiums were already there, so you won't have white elephants like you've had for all the previous World Cups in Russia, South Africa, Qatar, Brazil. They're all left with white elephant stadiums that are completely useless. You won't have that here. You didn't have to build anything new. That's great. But no, there's no financial benefit. And cities like Boston and the state of New Jersey would be very disappointed once they discovered this, which had they, you know, spent $20 on Soconomics, whatever it is, they would have known before.
There's also the Trump factor here. Before the games, you predicted that Trump's politics or his personality would shape the tournament's narrative in some way. And then, of course, we saw him get involved in the Balogun red card situation. What did you make of that?
Yeah, so I'd expected Trump actually to be more present during the World Cup because he was very excited beforehand. He saw it as the biggest TV series in the world where he would be the guest star. And he hasn't, I think, because he's getting old, because he was busy with his birthday and the 250th birthday of America, which was almost the same thing in the war in Iran. And also he went to the New York Knicks just before the World Cup and was very loudly booed by the crowd. And that would happen if he'd been to any World Cup stadium. So I think we're only going to see him at the final of the World Cup. So yes, the Balogun intervention was his only intervention so far, but very important because Trump likes to break rules in public. He's proud of breaking rules. In this case, the rule they broke was following Balogun, the best US goal scorer, had a red card in the game against Bosnia, so he wasn't eligible to play against Belgium. Strict FIFA rule, you get a red card, it's been the case for 60 years, you can't play the next game of the World Cup. But Trump calls Gianni Infantino, the FIFA president, the red card is rescinded, Balogun plays. Happily, it doesn't help to anyone who likes fans, and Belgium won 4-1. Now, that was hugely damaging to the World Cup, not just now, but I think for a long time to come. Because normally, I mean, I write in World Cup Fever about how I don't always trust the refereeing of World Cups. I think certain federations have a role in choosing referees. I don't trust FIFA always to make a call strictly on sporting grounds. But usually that's behind the scenes. We don't see it. We can try and ignore it. Trump does it in public, and now it's very clear FIFA is not a straight dealer. FIFA broke its own rules. And so since then, you've had a lot of conspiracy theories about refereeing and FIFA, especially around Argentina. So now everyone's saying, without evidence, that FIFA is favoring Argentina. FIFA needs Leo Messi to reach the final World Cup. I don't think it's as simple as that, but I completely understand why these conspiracy theories have blown up, because FIFA showed that it's not a straight dealer in the Trump-Balogun case.
The other thing playing out in public, to use your phrase, is racism. And of course, racism isn't a problem that soccer created, but the sport often becomes a stage where the racism that exists in society is exposed. Why do we continue to see these incidents at major tournaments? And what responsibility does FIFA have to really try to crack down on it?
Yeah, so I wouldn't necessarily blame FIFA. So to me, the big eruptions of racism have been against the French team, which is mostly players of immigrant origin, mostly of Black African or Arab African origin. And so you get people saying, and this is a far-right trope about Europe much broader than the French football team, and it focuses here on the French soccer team. You get people saying, like the former Spanish Prime Minister, Mariano Rajoy, say, France is not a team of French players, meaning these guys, they're born in France, they spend their childhoods in France, they learn their soccer in France, but they're not really French. Now, how, in what way are they not really French? Because they were born there, they have citizenship. What he means is, if they're Black, they're not French. Now, clearly that's racism. If you're defining Frenchness as a racial caste group, you have to be white to be French in his mind. And he's not the only one. This is a far-right idea around the world. So a Paraguayan senator made these disgusting racist comments about Mbappe, you know, Mbappe, French striker, which I'll repeat, which Mbappe replying, as usual, with great indignancy. And the former Paraguayan goalkeeper, Jose Chilavert, said similar things. And it's a far-right trope, which also some French fans have as well. They regard their team as not fully French because many of the players are of African extraction, immigrant families in France. And this is a big debate in France, where the far-right is quite likely to win the presidential elections next year. So, I mean, it also fits into what Donald Trump and his administration view Europe as. which is they view it as a place where the native population, the white people, are being replaced by these non-white people, and that's wrong, and these non-white people are not really English or French or Belgian or whatever. And so Europe is losing its cultural identity. So this nonsense racist language we hear around the World Cup is an extension of the nonsense racist language we hear in the political debate.
Yeah, let's talk more about the game, because this is the last World Cup for Cristiano Ronaldo. It's likely the last World Cup for Messi, too. What does the end of that two-decade rivalry in this sport mean for soccer?
I think the rivalry ended about 3 years ago when they both left European soccer, Messi to play in Miami and Ronaldo to play in Saudi Arabia. And they both decided they were kind of done with big soccer. And at that age they had, Messi was then about 36, Ronaldo 38, 39. It was natural. There'd never been a great footballer continuing at top level beyond then. And in Ronaldo's case, it's been true. I mean, he's not a great footballer anymore. He hasn't been for about 4 or 5 years. And so their rivalry of 15 years when they were both at their peaks was glorious. I think they both became better to compete with the other, because it's hard to be great alone. So John McEnroe, the tennis player, was very disappointed when Bjorn Borg retired, because McEnroe wanted to have a rivalry for years and years where they made each other better. And Messi and Ronaldo had that. But Ronaldo became old and bad, and Messi became old and, I think to his own surprise, remained brilliant. I think Messi had not imagined, when he won the World Cup in 2022, and he said it was his last and it was his last final, he had not imagined that at 39 he'd still be the best player in the world back here.
Simon, you have described the World Cup as a festival of corruption, profiteering, and nationalist chauvinism, and yet you keep coming back. This is now 10 tournaments and counting. Why?
It is that, but it's also beautiful, and it's also a festival of joy. It's a party that unites the whole world. Everyone is watching. Everybody, almost everyone, shares the love and appreciation of great soccer. Everybody appreciates the drama. And so I think you have to keep two things about in your head about the World Cup all the time. There is corruption and greed and political manipulation. But there's also enormous beauty and joy. I mean, there's nothing that unites a country in Europe, in Africa, like a game, it's the national team playing a game in the World Cup. It's just, it's like a national party.
We're headed into the finals. When you think back, what were your favorite finals matches to watch?
I mean, there's no doubt that in my lifetime, or the years I've been watching soccer, the best final was the last one, 2022, France-Argentina in Qatar. France don't show up the first half. They play like they're zombies, drugged. They can barely move. They suddenly, in the 60th minute, get it together. And it's a 3-3 game in the last minute. France, 1-on-1 against the keeper, Anokolo Muani. He shoots against the keeper's leg. France don't win, goes to penalties, Argentina win. Just the drama. I remember thinking at the end of that hour of magnificent play from the 60th minute onwards, what happened here? It was like you've been transported into this other realm, like you've been living inside a movie. And it was the most dramatic experience I've had at a football match.
Simon Cooper, author of World Cup Fever, A Soccer Journey in 9 Tournaments, and co-author of Soccernomics. A real pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you.